I'm Steve. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Steve.
We love you, Steve. Lots and lots and lots. And whole lunches.
That was not what I heard when I came to AA. people were like, get the hell out and don't come back. You know, we don't want to see you around here again. They didn't tell me when they asked me to talk at this, that I was on a panel. I was expecting like mixed group and whatever. And so I'm not sure what the subject is about being a man and being an alcoholic, you know. So I qualify in both areas. So I guess that we're going to hear about that a little bit. I had my last drink on December the 19th, 1968. And I was 21 years old. I called Alcoholics Anonymous at that point because life pretty much sucked, and I figured out that day that it was going to continue to suck from now on. I was never going to be any different than I was on that day. You know, it wasn't a particularly bad day. I mean, I wasn't in jail, and I was had a job temporarily, and, you know, things were okay for the day, but I had planned on being better than I was. You know, I had figured out that one of these days I'm going to shape up, get a real job, get a car, girlfriend, you know, place to live. I was living in a Skid Row hotel. It was $14 a week. I'm 2 weeks behind on the rent. I could get 14 bucks. Couldn't afford to give it to those guys, you know. So I started drinking when I was 17 years old, and in that next 4 years, I managed to get arrested in Iowa, California, Texas, Pennsylvania, South Dakota, California again, you know. I was on probation from about a month after I started drinking, and they told me, they gave you a list of stuff to not do mostly. First thing on the list, don't drink. No drinking. Well, I was pretty sure they didn't mean like no drinking, you know, what they really meant, don't get caught drunk. So I made every effort not to get caught drunk, and I wasn't very good at it. I kept getting caught, but this is back before they had computers, and so if you moved around a little bit, you could get in trouble all over the place, and the guys that you were in trouble with didn't know that you were already in trouble. You know, so I had, at one time, I had three probations going under different judges, all for drinking, and they all said, don't drink, you know, and so that was pretty much it. I was on probation from a month after I started drinking until I was sober for about 3 years. So there was no lapse in there at all, and I was generally in multiple kinds of trouble, you know, because I drank, and you do stupid stuff when you drink. You know, the most serious thing that happened to me was I stole a dump truck because I needed a ride home, you know, and it had a hot tar tank on a trailer on the back, and I lost the trailer somewhere, and so I woke up in jail for grand theft, and I owe a lot of money, and, you know, those are kind of things that happen to alcoholics, you know. My drinking was... It's typical for a person who has alcoholism, because we can be nice people when we're sober and we're a good friend and we're show up mostly, you know, and then we start drinking and we forget about all that good behavior, you know. It's all about me and about I'm feeling good, you know, I want to be the life of the party, and I am, and I do stuff that, even though I might have thought about it when I was sober, I'll actually do it when I've been drinking, you know. Somebody says, hey, let's go to Alabama and harvest wild rice. We can make a fortune. All right, let me get my bag. You know, I'm ready. We're going. You know, I did stuff like that. So I arrived in AA with having really burned most of my bridges. There was nobody trying to introduce me to their daughter. You know, my parents were not accepting any collect phone calls. This is when you had actually, you know, like pay phones and stuff. And you called the operator and said, I want to make a collect call, and they told them who it was that was calling, and then they would say if they would accept the charges or not. And well, my parents stopped accepting. You know, they didn't want to hear from me, because the only time they heard from me was when usually I was calling from jail, you know, 1 o'clock in the morning, you know. You know, hey, could you send $3,000 so I can shape up, you know, and, you know, they didn't really want to do that. So I arrived in AA and I stopped drinking, and I went to my first meeting. I remember the people there said that they were glad to see me and please keep coming back. Well, I didn't realize, first of all, that they said that to everybody. You know, I thought, oh, you know, hey, I'm kind of special. You know, these guys like me, and nobody had been glad to see me in a long time. So, and I obviously didn't have anything else going on, so I did come back. And the guys that had picked me up for the first time, they took me to the meeting, and then we went out for coffee after the meeting. This is in California, so meetings started like at 8:30 at night, and they were hour and a half meetings, so we got out at 10, and we went to the coffee shop, and then we talked about who was full of shit at the meeting and who knew what they're talking about, what's going on. And so then they dropped me off at home about midnight, and I just barely get to bed, and I'm up and have to go to work, and they pick me up from work the next day. We go to another meeting, and then afterwards we go to the coffee shop, and then this goes on for about a week, and I realize, hey, I haven't had a chance to drink. You know, these guys have been watching me the whole time. But I already recognized that there's like people behind me, and I'm not going to let those bastards catch up, because there's some status to be had by being sober longer than somebody, you know. So I want to stay where I am. I don't want to lose my place, so I'm not drinking. But I did not recognize that in order to be sober, I had to change. I didn't know about that. I thought we would hang out, pat each other on the back, tell each other how great we're doing, you're looking good, man, you know, don't drink, and that's all I figured there was, you know. Well, that's not enough. You know, being an alcoholic, I'm going to be an alcoholic for the rest of my life. That was the thing I didn't recognize in the beginning, was that alcoholism is a permanent condition. I'm never in my lifetime going to be able to safely drink alcohol. And so I have to figure out some way to, how do I keep from drinking? You know, I could see how I could do it while these guys are watching, but what happens after they think I'm going to stay sober and they're not watching anymore? I got a pocket full of money. How am I going to keep from going slipping in the bar? I didn't know that part. I didn't know what was going to happen. But I wasn't there yet, so I went to a lot of meetings. I hung out with other alcoholics, and I didn't drink. Now, I didn't really change very much either. I was not very honest, and I didn't really have any life skills. You know, you start drinking right out of high school and drink all your way till AA, and you don't really learn stuff, or at least I didn't. I might have learned it, but I forgot, you know. That happened to me. And so I had to learn how do you go to work and show up and pay bills and whatever, and I didn't do a very good job at that my first year. And so I didn't manage my sleep time very well, and when I'd stay up too late and then I was tired at work, and so I started taking amphetamines to go to work. And I was taking some Benzedrine, which you could get like, you get a roll of them, they wrapped them up in foil, they were like 10 pills for a buck. Now, put this in perspective, though, a dollar was like, minimum wage then was $1.65 an hour, so that's what I was making. And so I would buy some amphetamines, and even if I was tired, you take two bennies and you're going to have a spiritual awakening in about a half an hour, you know? So I go to work, I work hard, and everybody else went home, I'm still working, you know, and I was productive, and I thought, you know, this is not a bad deal. You know, I'm not drinking, I'm not getting arrested, and I'm doing a lot of work, you know. And then somebody would come along and had some weed, and I'd smoke a little weed, and I thought, oh, this is kind of mellowed me out. This is a good deal, you know. And I didn't seem to have the problems that I had when I was drinking. And so I didn't really think that this was inconsistent with my program in AA. And I remember a fellow that I knew was giving me a ride home from a meeting one night, and I mentioned to him that I smoke a little weed now and again, and he got this shocked look on his face, and he said, "Well, I don't think that's consistent with the spiritual program of recovery." And I decided right then and there to just stop talking about it. You know, I could see that, you know, these older guys didn't really understand where I was coming from, so I just kept it to myself, you know. Well, as it turned out, I managed not to drink, and after a year, I took a birthday cake, you know, at the AA meeting, and they didn't even check, you know, they didn't send anybody out to talk to the neighbors and see if you really been staying sober or anything. You say you're sober, they sing, you know, that's pretty much it. So here I got a year of sobriety, and I'm, you know, working. I had moved on to being a dishwasher on a graveyard shift, and I got on a little speed run there, and I was taking Benzedrines. I took them the first day because I needed to meet my probation officer, and then when I got done talking to him, I wasn't really tired, and I didn't really get tired again for about 4 days. And I had a attack of paranoia while I was at work one night. It's like 3 a.m. and I realized that there's people coming to get me, and I didn't know who they were. And so every time the kitchen door would like crack open, I'd have to make a quick decision whether to like dive under the dishwasher and hide or look busy. And I had an experience where I kind of stepped out of myself, and I saw this whole scene, and I recognized that if I told somebody I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, that they didn't really have a good reason to believe me. Because most of the people I knew in AA, they kind of moseyed around from place to place, and I was zipping from place to place. Everything in my life was an emergency. And so I did what I really didn't want to do. The following day, I went to an AA meeting. It was a 2 o'clock in the afternoon meeting in Laguna Beach, California. And I told them I'd been taking amphetamines and smoking weed. And they said what I was afraid they were going to say. They said, "Man, you've got to start over." And I thought, well, shit, a whole year's worth of newcomers just passed me up, you know. It was really discouraging because the only thing I'd accomplished in my life up to that point was getting sober for a year. I had a year without drinking, and now they deducted it, you know. And I'm like, crap, you know, this is a bad deal. But what I did know was that if I kept doing what I was doing, I was going to drink again. And I had already recognized that I can never drink alcohol again in my life. As somebody mentioned in a meeting a little earlier, if I decided to drink, it was me deciding to kill myself, because that's pretty much what was going to happen. My life was going to go down the tubes in a hurry. And so I started over again, and I found out that I had to actually work steps. And so I was doing steps, but it was hard, you know. I really had a hard time focusing. I kind of underestimated the effect of the amphetamines on me, and my mind would run amok. I'd go to an AA meeting, I'd have 5 cups of coffee, we'd talk about spiritual stuff, I was feeling great. I'd get home, I'm laying in bed, and I think, what the hell were you thinking? Life sucks. It's never going to get any better. You might as well just kill yourself right now, you know. And I actually seriously thought about doing that, and I was going to drive my car over the cliff, and then I remembered my car is such a piece of shit it won't even make it through the guardrail. So it occurred to me, you know, if I kill myself, they're going to talk about me down at the young people's meeting on Friday. You know, they're going to say, well, you know, Steve had to kill himself because he didn't take his inventory. I thought, I'll show those bastards. I'll take the inventory. I'll leave it laying next to my body. They'll know why I did it. You know, I mean, it's all right there. So I wrote the inventory out, and then I recognized right away, well, shit, I already knew all this stuff, you know. The reason I was thinking that AA wasn't going to work, and the way to prove that it doesn't work is you have to actually do it, and then watch it not work. And so I said, okay, I'm going to call my sponsor, and I'll do a fifth step, and as soon as he rejects me, then I can kill myself, and it'll be fine, you know. And so he he didn't realize how urgent it was. He said, "Oh, I'll come right over next Wednesday," you know, and I'm like, "Well, yeah. Shit." So I had postponed killing myself for a few days. And and I took a fifth step with Charlie. And Charlie was sober 9 years, and he had a nice house in San Juan Capistrano, and he had to work like two jobs to pay for the house, and he had a good car, and he had a wife that she would have made me drink, but he seemed okay with her. And so anyway, I told him all the stuff that was on my inventory, and I thought that he would have the expect me to have been a lot better than that, you know, because that's what I thought. I know I wasn't the worst guy on the planet, but I had turned out a lot worse than I expected to be. You know, I figured I should have been much better than this, and I wasn't. I had not lived up to my own standards, and I thought that that's what he would think too. Well, he told me stories about himself, and he said, you know, he had been doing the same stuff I'd been doing, and in some cases he'd been doing it quite a bit longer than I had, and he didn't feel like killing himself. He's got a smile on his face, and he's living a good life. Not everything's perfect, but he's okay with it. And when I got done with this, I thought, this might work. You know, maybe it will work. And then immediately I'm thinking, you know, hey, I'm like, I can start going to meetings where they're talking about the fourth step now, because I got something to say, you know. And I started feeling like a real AA member. Because really, up until this point, everybody has to take your word for the fact that you're working the program. You say, "I'm turning my life over to God." Yeah, right. You know, let's see some evidence of that, you know. Well, now I've got papers, you know. I got a witness. I got a guy, you know, he can say, "Yes, people were over at my house working the steps," you know. So I'm like, okay, I'm in there, you know. And my attitude kind of changed. And I will say that I haven't, like, sped through recovery. I didn't go through a sober house or anything where the people were leaning on me to do the work, you know. I had to lean on myself, and I didn't really want to most of the time, but I drug it out as much as possible. But once you recognize you're an alcoholic and that this is the way that we recover, you know, this is the way we manage to stay sober, you can't let yourself get too close to the edge, you know. Taking the drink is going off the edge of the cliff. And in the beginning, I was close to the edge of the cliff all the time. You know, it was always, I could at any time pick up a drink. Well, after a few months, I wasn't as close to the edge. And so, yeah, I wasn't as likely to pick up a drink, but I might start being a little more dishonest, which would get me closer to the edge. You know, and so as we go on in our sobriety, what we're working at is staying away from the edge. You know, so I'm sober for 44 years now, and I don't think about drinking seriously hardly ever, but I have stuff that I have to do so that drinking doesn't become a good idea 6 months from now or next year or whenever. You know, I don't want that to happen to me, and I know that it can happen. A good friend of mine, I met him when I was 2 years sober. He was, I guess, almost 8 years sober. He drank a few years ago after 43 years of sobriety. And, yeah, he was doing stuff. I mean, we could all say, "Oh, yeah, I saw it coming." But you know what? What it told me is we're not guaranteed sobriety from now on. It is still a work in progress, and I still have to do that work. And so I am one of the ways that I do the work is by sharing my story with others, because it's impossible to do this and forget that you're an alcoholic. You know, I do talk at meetings. I did for many years. I went into institutions. I did jail meetings, because if you sit across from a guy in an orange suit, you're going to remember what it's like being an alcoholic, you know, because I know what that feels like. And I know how good it feels when I get up and leave at the end too. So, I'm glad to be here today. You know, it's hard to encapsulate what I've done in my sobriety, but what I have to say about that is that I am still learning, I'm still growing, I'm still finding interesting things to do by being sober and alive at 67 years old now. And, you know, I was 22 when I finally got sober, and I had no expectation to be here, and I don't think anybody that knew me did either, that they didn't think I was going to be alive this long or even half of this long. And so I woke up today I'm pretty darn grateful for being alive and for being a sober alcoholic. So thank you, guys. Thank you.
My name's Michael. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Michael.
I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really do love Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is 12/13/07. My home group is the Winners Podium Group in Flagstaff, Arizona, every Friday night, and my sponsor is Russ and John. I work with two sponsors weekly basis, you know, and I think for the past 6.5 years, I've probably met with them, or I've only been working with John for about a year, but I've met with Russ almost 90% of the time, as far as like every week we've almost met, you know, and that's been vital for me. Not only for, my sobriety, but for understanding and finding an example of what I want to be like, right? Or an ideal to grow towards. I guess to quickly qualify, you know, I started messing around at 13 years old. By 15 years old, I lost the power of choice. By 17 or 18, I was drinking 4 or 5 nights a week, and they were lots of liquor, actually lots of beer, a couple, you know, little liquor. And then that changed once I got on probation. I had to put away outside issues, and I focused solely on vodka, and I was like dedicated, you know. I was a dedicated vodka drinker, and I went through, been through 2 treatment places. I sobered up my first time when I was 21, and by 21 years old, I had a story that should have kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous, yet my effort did not keep me in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was 23, I had added 4 months to that story, and it kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous, and today, that's my sobriety date, and I'm really grateful for that. You know, I have no idea what, even my mind today, right? So after 6 years of sobriety, after experiencing all the ups and downs of sobriety and of life, relationships and finances and stuff like that, my mind still tells me that I'm inadequate to talk to you guys about what it's like to be a man, right? And so I guess that's just me sharing about what a lot of us may feel. I don't know, you know, I don't know what you're thinking, you know, but what's going on in my head is that, you know what, I don't have the content to describe what a man should be or what the goal should be or the ideal should be, right? And so if you've ever had doubt or fear or shame or guilt, etc., etc., I believe that that's just the human condition. And you know, even when I'm super comfortable in my life, right, I'm very happy at where my life is like right now, I still have doubt that it's not good enough, you know, that there's still more to get, you know, that I've got to get a couple other little things here and a couple other things on this area of life, and that's my mind, right? But the truth is that I've worked really hard, I mean really hard, and dedicated a lot of time to not only sobriety, but to the content of life, you know, and I don't know what that means for you, but I'll talk a little bit about what it means for me. You know, the biggest part in my life really that kind of started this whole thing was that my dad died when I was 7 years old, right? So I did not have a dad or a male figure in my life at all, literally at all, you know, like there was, you know, fathers around, but no, nobody was there, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really grateful that Mom never dated or brought in another male, because I probably just would have freaked out and reacted or would, you know, like pushed away or whatever. But Dad died of a massive heart attack, you know, like I don't know if you guys seen the movie Baby, but we're watching Baby, right? And he's there and he's a cop and he's been, you know, SWAT motorcycles, helicopters, etc., etc. And he bends down to tie his right shoe and he has a massive heart attack and he dies right in front of me, right? And so it's me and my brother. My mom calls the ambulance, and that's how things start off at 7. So there was never like this example. I had a grandpa who was just a curmudgeon, right? And he was an alcoholic that had to stop drinking but had no solution. So you had this miserable guy, miserable. And I was really grateful to see that in sobriety, that that's what I'm going to become. He said he went to one of the wars, and I thought it was two, but he had like a bomb and a machine gun little speaker thing on his dash. And he'd curse violently and aggressively at people in front of him who were not driving the way he expected them to. And he would press these buttons, you know? And when we would press the button as children, he'd be like, you need to knock that off, right? And he used other choice words, but that's just how uncomfortable he was, like internally, you know, his soul was just restless. So, good guy, smart enough guy, but just, I mean, just grumpy as they come, you know? He was a classic guy. So, I mean, like, that was around, and then, you know, the other grandpa was around, and he was a much better example of, he was calm, collected, and today I know only that because I've looked back and like really tried to remember the content of their character. Because when my own content is at stake, right, when I'm doing inventory work, I look for examples, I look for an ideal. And not always is it my family, not always is it my friends, but I get to pick and choose, right? And when I'm failing in one area or another, see, the obsession has been removed from me. But I will put other things in the way of whatever else, right? So, like, my sexual urges come up and get out of there. My anger, my resentment, talking crap about people. All that stuff is what's going to bring me back to the drink, right? These defects of character. So, when I was, like, a kid, right? I'm, like, watching movies, watching TNT. You know, we stopped going to church because we were watching wrestling and that was much more important. So it's like, my idols were like the Ultimate Warrior, Jean-Claude Van Damme, right? Anything that's going on TNT, anything that's on TBS, you know? I mean, like, this is where I'm gaining life from, right? Like, The Babysitter and, you know, like Nickelodeon, stuff like that, you know? And I watched a lot of Full House, but I could never pull the lesson out of Full House, you know? I could never pull the lesson out of Family Matters, you know? I had no idea what was going on there. I'd watch it just because I was, like, numb to the world eating bologna sandwiches, because that's what I ate that in, you know? And, like, this is my life, you know? I'm just some goofy, tightly wound individual, and it's hard to paint a picture of how odd of a kid I was, but I was just an odd kid. Was very emotionally sensitive, and you know, people would like literally poke fun at me for a couple of minutes and I'd start crying, you know, and they took advantage of that, you know, when I'm in fourth, fifth, and sixth, because I went to a private school really early and it was a Montessori, and they would like, you know, they were very supportive of that kind of stuff. And but once I got into public school, I had no idea how to ask for help, and I was just, I didn't know how to, like, interact, really. I didn't know that you could tell people to be quiet. And I was tall. I mean, like, I wasn't big, but I was tall. But these people would just walk all over me, you know? Who knows? You know, I don't know. But I'm really glad I grew out of that one eventually. So you just have this odd kid who goes about life and has no idea that examples are there for him to absorb. And until I got into sobriety, did I finally was able to clear my head out enough and dump enough of the old beliefs and the old ways of thinking in order to adopt new and effective ways of living and being. And, you know, I just struggled. I struggled for a long time. I thought that the money in my pocket and the truck that I'm driving and the way I treat women, I thought those are what was the content of a man, right? I was mistaken a lot. The words that I say, and the outside shell, right? And my dad was a really kind heart, and he was a big guy. He was a football player. I mean, so he was like stacked. He was 6 feet. And what I know from my uncle is that he just looks scary. You know, I mean, he was a Green Beret, so I assume he looks scary. But really, he was a really kind soul inside. But I never could remember that. I never could pull that out. You know, I remember him, you know, barely one time we almost watched him go to a SWAT thing and He was very calm and collected about it all. You know, you guys need to just eat your dinner and we'll go to this thing, you know? And it's just like, you know, he's on his way to go probably break into a house and shut some people down, however he does it. But he was very methodical about it. And up until recently, I started talking with a couple of his friends, and I start to get a better idea of where I come from, right? And it's pretty cool. And they're very emotional driven in God. I mean, like, we start crying and it just is like such a healing process inside of that. And my brother is very stoic and he doesn't cry, right? But when you bring up this whole thing, he starts crying. And it's just like, oh, it's so healing. It's really beautiful. So anyways, I'm, you know, running around life driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, all this stuff that I thought was what I was supposed to be doing, what I was supposed to be gaining. And I was really mistaken about kind of how to live life. You know, my mom was a kind, gentle woman, and all that stuff was there for me to grab, and I just never took it. I never took it, and I don't know why. So I get sobered up in jail. I get arrested, thank God, and I go through a treatment center that's inside the county jail, and it starts the gears turning, right? But I'm under the belief that Alcoholics Anonymous is an action-oriented, not so much a thinking deal. And I get out, and I find a guy who's just got a good glow about him. He's just a happy-go-lucky kind of guy, right? And that's Russ. He's just a goofy guy, you know? Just, he has a really good, strong pizzazz about life, about Alcoholics Anonymous, about just going about life in general. And so I start working with him, and one of the big things he told me early on is he said, you know what you're gonna do is you're gonna fucking hurt some women, and you don't belong hurting women. Okay? And what I heard was I should stay away from women, and I'm really glad I heard that. That may have not been what he said, but that's what I needed to know. I needed to stay away, and I needed to truly work on myself. And I'm really grateful he told that. So I tell a lot of my sponsees that, you know. I don't say you're not gonna get in a relationship, and when they eventually do, I say just don't get her pregnant, dude. And that's like the best advice I could ever give, you know. It's just like, give yourself some time, man. I'm not there to control every little aspect of your life. But give yourself some time, you know. It's like, even at 5 years sober, I'm starting the process to begin who I am, what I want. What direction do I want to go in life? Do I want to continue education? Stuff like that. And so I just like wish him the best, you know. It's just like, good luck, buddy, you know. Because I can't, you know, what am I going to say? And what are they actually going to do? Well, I'm not going to tell that asshole anything anymore, you know, because that worked out real well. So my sponsor always picked me up and always brought me along. He was always picking me up and always bringing me along. And he worked with a lot of guys, but he was pretty tied to a sober living house in Flagstaff. And so he would just swing by, grab guys, and go, right? And he'd be like, hey, let's make some coffee. And I'd be like, all right, let's make some coffee. You know, and so he'd do that for like 2 or 3 weeks. And then he'd say, all right, you go make the coffee. And I'm like, all right, I know how to make coffee. And he would show me how to do a lot of that stuff. And so slowly I was starting to see what behaviors that I wanted and that I didn't want. Right? And I would watch Alcoholics Anonymous, and he would be sitting next to me in a meeting. He'd say, hey, see that man who's sitting by that girl? And I'm like, yeah, that's George, right? George, yeah. George has no idea what's going to happen, right? But they're already together. So watch them over the next course of months, right? And watch what happens to George and her, right? And you would watch it unfold right in front of you. And usually both of them would drink, you know, because they're new and they're looking for something that is exterior for an internal sickness, right? My spiritual malady manifested itself when I was a young kid. Right? I hadn't even taken a drink or a drug till I was 13 or 12. And when I'm in third grade, I'm cheating on tests so that I look better. When I'm in fourth grade, I'm stealing cigarettes to make you think that I'm a better person. When I'm in fifth grade, I'm lying, manipulating to get money in order to go do stuff so I have money so you think something different of me. Right? That's the manifestation of my sickness. it exists today, you know? Just because I've worked a lot of myself and taken a couple inventories don't mean shit. You know, it just comes back up, you know? We went through this fourth step, right? And I got to see a lot of the fancy and real fears that I had. And that is what's been pushing me for so long, right? And my fancy fear is that you know my past, right? You know what has happened to me. So therefore, you already are better than me. Because this hasn't happened to you, right? And it's just this story. It's crazy. I don't know where it comes from. But I just feel inadequate coming to the table no matter what. And slowly, over the action of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to have self-esteem, right? Because I came into Alcoholics Anonymous just an empty can, right? And I had a bunch of terrible beliefs, you know? And I'm sober, and I like what he said yesterday. Is like, oh God, now I can't remember what he said. Anyways, if I'm sober and I'm getting worse. I'm sober and I'm getting worse because I have all these defects of character and nothing to treat that with. And so I had to start immediately discarding stuff that was just not useful, is ineffective for living a sober life, you know, a good, healthy, sober life that had content, that had value. You know, I'm under the impression that the only way to gain self-esteem is to do esteemable things, you know, and if you can't wait for those things to come to you, you have to go to them. And that's just for me, that's what I had to do. And so I had to start giving my time. I had to start really that process of self-sacrifice. And I didn't see the correlation early. My sponsor probably told me about the correlation, but you know, the more you do for others, the better it builds up yourself. And all of a sudden, at like 2.5 years, I had value. You know, I actually had characteristics that were valuable not only to myself, but to other people around me. And since then, they have become more and more valuable, and yet I still struggle in this area and that area and this area and that area, right? And I think that that's, you know, one of the things that I'm okay with today is that I'm just a flawed male that will always be flawed, that will always have assets, that will always have defects, right? And it's just like, how can I accentuate those assets and like really kind of push away those defects? And just for me, like, I love in the 12 and 12 when it says a logical interwoven, something of, to that sort of, 10, 11, and 12 creates an unshakable foundation of reliance. And I can't remember if that's not exactly what it talks about, but it talks about knowing where you're at in all three of those and combining them. And it really, I really love that line. And so it's like, well, now that I know the line and I love the line, am I actually fucking doing the work, right? And it, and the truth is, for a year and a half, just a month ago, I was not doing the work. But a year before that, I was doing the work, right? And I'm back into that work. And so, you know, I have no doubt in my mind that when I'm active in those kinds of small things, right? Not just praying, because meditation is bonus points, right? When I'm actually doing an inventory, right? And actually consciously looking at my day yesterday, and then actually praying and meditating and allowing myself to have reliance, right? I'll get to how I interact with that higher power, that creation. But relying, asking questions, hey, should I go here? Hey, is this okay? You know, I have like all these wonderful stories about what reliance does. And reliance for me is like when I get the notion or that God conscious, right? They talk about developing a vital sixth sense. When I have that going on, I'm more sensitive to what the world needs of me, right? I'm more sensitive to how am I going to grow in understanding and effectiveness for you, you know? Because it's not about me, right? I know that this will never be about me. My life is no longer any of my business, right? I don't care if I get the truck anymore. I don't care if I get the girl anymore. I don't care if I go to school. I don't care about the job. All I really cared about at the start and even today is sober. Because if I'm sober, all of this stuff will come anyways, right? And if you're in here and you have doubt and you're uncomfortable, know that there's stuff that's coming down the pipeline that you have no idea. It will baffle you once it arrives, you know? You're just going to be blown away. And you're just going to be like, how did this unfold? How did this happen to me? You know, I'm looking at my past and it's like, I should not work in a federal institution, but today I work in a federal institution. And it's just like, I have keys, you know? I am leaving this door and you can say nothing about it. When they say you're gonna get the keys to the kingdom, they're not joking, you know? Like, you're really gonna get some keys, you know? You'll get keys to motorcycles and keys to houses and keys to your cars. You know, it's gonna blow you away. You're gonna be like, dude, this, I mean, I'll bet you that 80% of the people in this room never lost a house, never lost any of that, because we never got it in the first place. You know what I'm saying? I will speak for myself that I never got it, and I was given, and I had no respect for those things. You know, I treated them. I was not a good steward of money. I was not a good steward of vehicles, homes, whatever, jobs, because I never had to work for it. They were always just kind of put there. You know, but today I have a content that I've worked really hard for the job that I have. I've worked really hard to have the house that I have, to have the things that of life, right? Like he was talking about, the things of life. And my AA life has never gotten in the way of the life AA has given me. And that's not out of any virtue of my own, you know? It's not like, oh, I've done this, you know? No, I've always just worked with newcomers, you know? My goal has never been to give all of my time away, and I have given a lot of my time away. 20 minutes flew by that fast. I am so full of shit. So, I mean, I guess, you know, what it means to me is that I had to get rid of everything that was in my old cup, truly. And if you have ideas or beliefs, the educational variety has taken some out. And I've lived sour in a little bit, and then they have put good stuff in and taken some out and put good stuff in. I don't treat women the same way, and I don't think about women the same way. I don't treat my cars. I don't treat the world like I used to treat it. It was a slow process, a lot of work. One thing that, God loves sex. God gave boobs and vaginas for men to enjoy and really have a relationship with, right? Not just the vagina and the boobs, but the actual individual. And I can't wait till women hear this on the internet. But anyways, you know, like, my sponsor had talked always about reliance. And so before dating, I went through 5 years of dating. And the purpose of the 5 years of dating was not to get in a relationship. I was to date to get a handle on myself and my emotions. So that when it comes to women, and I'm not driven by fear, I'm not driven by doubt, I'm not driven by lust, I'm not driven by that stuff, like, to hold on and to, like, capture, you know, and, I don't, you know, like, I don't take a hostage, you know, cause I would love to take a hostage, right? Like, on more ways than one. You know, but like, my reliance, I asked a lot, and there was one girl in particular where I asked, hey, can I take her on a date? And the conscious told me no. And I asked again, like a couple months later, hey, can I take her on a date? And the conscious told me no. And I was shut down for 8 months. Every time I asked, hey, can I take her on a date? And finally, the notion came back, all right, you can take her on a date, right? And I am currently in a relationship with her, and it's amazing. Because I took the back seat and did the work, God really provided something that had substance. It has depth and weight, right? It's really a beautiful thing. And it just, it continues to blow me away that God is that good to each one of us, right? It's not just to me, but to each one of us. So anyways, thank you for letting me share.
My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic.
Danny. We love you, Danny.
I love you, too.
And oh, what is good.
Thank you. I love you, too. I should have went first. I don't know how much I have to add to that. All I can really do is tell you my experience, right? My sobriety date is March 17th, 2011. I have a sponsor, a home group. I've worked steps. I've worked with others. Book says something to the effect of we have to let go of our old ideas entirely, right? When I came into the rooms, I had this idea of what a man was, right? And some of those ideas were I don't cry. I don't show any emotion. I don't show any sensitivity to anything. I don't get emotionally intimate with another man, no matter what. I don't show any weakness. I don't rely on anybody else. I can do everything myself. I don't ask for help. And I'm sure there were some other ones I provide for myself, that sort of thing. And my experience in these rooms is that any time that I've grown, I've had to directly challenge one of those beliefs that I had before I got in here. Real quick, just to qualify, I got into the rooms after an attempted suicide because, I started drinking because there was an effect produced that I loved, and I drank more to try to produce that effect more. And it worked, and then it stopped working, and then my life became a miserable hellhole, and the only way I could find a way to escape I can't think of a word to describe it, right? But it's just despair, and if you're in this room, you probably understand it. Was to off myself, but that didn't work, thank God. So I went to treatment, and I at one point in treatment, and it was when I had gotten 30 days. See, I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol and weed. Like, I thought my problem were some other substances. And then I pick up 30 days, and within those 30 days, I had made that firm, deep resolution that I was going to stay sober from any and all substances for the rest of my life. And once it's all out of my system and I'm sober, then I'll be perfectly fine. And I had 30 days and I picked up that chip. And anybody's gotten their first 30-day chip, you remember that feeling of getting that first 30-day chip? It's like this miraculous, like, oh my God, I did the impossible feeling. And I get back to the treatment center and I have the 30-day chip. And then for some reason, the thought, just like our friend with the whiskey and the milk, I want to get loaded. And 30 minutes later, I find myself doing exactly that, right? And I find myself leaving treatment the next day just as scared and fearful as I entered that facility. And at that moment, I completely abandoned myself to, honestly, it was men, man. Anytime that I've grown in these rooms, it's because of either asking for help or being able to get emotionally intimate with somebody else, man. A couple of memories stand out in my mind. I remember I was in sober living and I was getting kicked out because I didn't have like the finances to pay for it, right? And I was pretty deep in, like, I shouldn't have been there anymore. I just couldn't make it work. And I finally get the news that I need to pack up and I need to leave and I need to find some other arrangements, and all that comes over me is just this mountain of fear and what's going to happen, and I failed again, and this just isn't going to work anymore. And I'm in my room and I'm like just bawling my eyes out and I don't care who sees me, and one of my buddies is there and he's like, what's going on, man? And I just like verbally vomit everything that's going on with my situation. I'm like, better get kicked out, my parents don't want me around no more, I'm going to be homeless, like, fuck it, I might as well just go get loaded and say fuck it. And he said, he's like, you call your sponsor? I was like, no. He's like, you should probably do that. Okay. It's like, and our home group was that night, and he's like, you should come to the home group meeting. Let's go. We're about to go right now. I'm like, all right, fine. And I get to the home group meeting, and I'm we're smoking outside, and I'm about to walk inside, and there's this old timer. He's got like 20 something years. He's a really good friend of mine today. But at the time, like, I had one, maybe two conversations with him. He had no reason to know me or go out of his way to talk to me, is basically what I'm trying to say. And I'm walking into the room, and he's like, how are you doing? And I give him the, oh, I'm doing all right. And I take another step, and he like grabs me by my shoulder and yanks me. He's like, no, fuck that, come out here. You're not. What's going on? And he showed me like how I was able to get honest with somebody else, get vulnerable with somebody else, get emotionally intimate with another man in this room, and I wouldn't be thought less than for it, right? And he explained to me how it was a measure of strength to be able to do that. And I worked through that situation and grew from that. There was another time, I don't know. he was talking about seeking these outside things. Like, right, I have a malady, right? And if anybody's in this room, I on a personal level would venture to bet that alcohol isn't the problem, right? Just like it says, liquor is but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions right before we worked that inventory, right? Like, alcohol isn't my problem. Because if it was, you remove the alcohol, I'm perfectly fine, but I'm fucking sick. And a couple of different ways that I've tried to fill that hole inside, right? Tried to heal that malady inside and make myself feel better, have been from outside things like women, like gambling. Which makes it really ironic that I'm at a WIPOC convention at a casino, right? It makes that shit very fucking apparent for me. But it also lets me know that like, there's more growth and more work to be done, and I have to be willing to do that work. And that's one of the things that, like, I have people, like, I've been able to get honest with other men in this program and be able to see that, like, one, I don't have to be this, like, machismo, macho person who, like, I always got my status from, before I got in the rooms, from money, from the women around me, from being the toughest, the most badass. Like, I wanted to be a thug before I got sober, right? Like, I wanted to be in the rap video and all that shit. And I've had a revolutionary change in the way that I view my life today. And it's incredibly hard for me to put into words, but you know that feeling when it happens, right? And I would think that a lot of people in here understand that feeling. I have absolutely no idea how to explain what being a man in recovery should be or should look like. And that's just the God's honest truth. All I can really do and all I try to do is become a better person on a day-to-day basis, right? And the rest of it takes care of itself. I try not to harm others, whether that's in my personal relationships with men, whether that's in intimate relationships with women, especially if that's with newcomers, because that's when we're the most vulnerable, right? That's when I need... You know, I have something for so long that's blocking out this malady inside of me, and then I get sober and I don't have that anymore, and I'm going to cling to absolutely anything that's going to fill that void, right? And sex does a really fucking good job of filling that void temporarily until I realize, holy shit, I'm sick again. And that's one thing that, like, my friends had to... When I was new, for like the first 4-6 months when I was in sober living, my friends had a joke anytime I was talking to a female that was also new that I had to be 20 feet away from them. And like nothing, they were just fucking with me. But it's honestly one of the best things that's ever happened because, you know, it's taught me to stay away from that. And I've seen a lot of people maintain and grow that sickness by, I don't know, man, by acting selfishly, I'll say, and hurting others. I don't know exactly where I was going with that, but all I really could do on a day-to-day basis is try to become a better person and not harm anybody else. Anything program related, man, these guys really covered perfectly, so I got nothing else to add. I'll pass.